best source of memorability, of course, is personal experience. I mean, people who live through floods take floods more seriously. But it doesn't require personal experience. A real good replacement for personal experience, when we look at the memorability of a risk, is the media, especially television. I've never been to Bhopal, I've never been to Chernobyl, but I learned from television and to a lesser extent from newspapers about the risks of nuclear power and the risks of chemical manufacturing from those two events. Okay. It doesn't have to be news. I do a lot of work with the biotechnology industry, and the memorability of biotechnology risks comes mostly from fiction. Okay, it's all those bad movies we saw when we were 13, The Gene That Ate Chicago. I'm not saying the risk is fiction. I don't know whether the risk is fiction or not, but its memorability comes very largely from fiction. Okay. Similarly, symbol value has a lot to do with memorability. Most of you probably remember the Alar controversy a few years ago, an additive in apples that helps them stay on the tree longer. Well, a lot of the memorability of that battle came from the apple as a symbol of innocence, and the poisoned apple as a symbol of the betrayal of innocence, starting with Adam and Eve, working our way through to Snow White, and on to the latest corporate takeover. We have vivid imagery of the poisoned apple. Okay. Now, every cartoonist in the country used that to talk about Alar, but that's not the point. The point is that every psyche in the country was primed for it, was ready for it. Okay. Imagine, if you will, that Alar, instead of being an additive on apples, was something you put in pork. Now, I think the Natural Resources Defense Council would have been too smart to go after an additive in pork, but suppose they had. The media would not have been very interested. The public would not have been very interested. Why? Nobody has any vision of pork getting any dirtier than it already is. But apples, apples. Now, think about that when you think of two bioengineered food products on their way to market, bioengineered pork and bioengineered milk. Okay? If there's any food with more symbolic freight than the apple, it's milk. If pork gets to market first, I would predict it'll sail right through. If milk gets to market first, there will be hell to pay, okay? Because of the memorability. Okay, so whether we're talking fiction, or we're talking news, or we're talking symbol, or we're talking personal experience, the more memorable the risk is, the more outrage it's going to generate. What can you do about that? I could advise you to avoid memorable accidents, but you probably don't need me to advise you to avoid memorable accidents. Where it's less obvious, I think, is the need to acknowledge the sources of memorability that are already there. I mean, try to imagine, I don't know, Richard Nixon talking about his presidency without mentioning Watergate. Okay, or Exxon talking about its environmental record without mentioning Valdez. And the audience is sitting there waiting to see if the spokesperson is going to mention Valdez. And until they talk about Valdez, you're only half listening, right? The other half of you is waiting to see how they will handle this obviously important issue. Okay. So the moral of the story is, if you're Exxon, you talk about Valdez early. You know, you go out there to give your environmental message, and you start as the company that brought you Valdez. Boy, are we thinking about the environment now. Whatever it is that's making the risk memorable, whether it's technically relevant or not, talk about it early, voluntarily. Okay? We're waiting to hear about it. Number five is the distinction between risks that are dreaded and risks that are not dreaded. And here again, I'm writing not dreaded because that's the safe side of the continuum. Now, I think you have to be a Jungian psychologist to know what dread means. And I'm not, but we all know the outcomes. What's the most dread disease in America today? AIDS, and what's number two? Cancer. Okay, now, I'm a specialist in environmental risk, and as far as I know, nothing that my clients work on causes AIDS, although further research is needed. Okay, but cancer is obviously a biggie, and you all know that the same amount of mortality, if it's attributable to cancer, is going to generate more public concern, more regulatory action, more media coverage than that amount of mortality attributed to some less dreaded disease like asthma or emphysema. Okay. Similarly, we have a powerful dread response to radiation. You talk about radiation, and even radiologists cross their legs. And, And an even more powerful dread response, I think, to waste. You don't have to be a very sophisticated observer of discussions of hazardous waste to notice that they're more about the noun than the adjective. You put a 55-gallon drum of hazardous raw materials in front of a plant, and people are moderately upset, okay, moderately concerned. You move that drum through the plant and out the back door and call it hazardous waste, and people go nuts. I mean, sometime when you're watching a discussion of hazardous waste, turn off the sound on the television and watch people's noses wrinkle. Okay, the classic nonverbal communication of disgust. Okay, a very close cousin of dread. Okay. Or turn the sound back up and count the number of times people use the rhetoric of control. We have to control the waste stream. Does this remind you of some key event in your life at about the age of 2? Now, I can't prove that discussions of hazardous waste are all about toilet training, okay? And even if they are, that doesn't mean the issue is a lot of BS, okay? But it does tell us something important diagnostically. It tells us that the dread is coming more from the fact that it's waste than from the fact that it's hazardous. Okay? What do we do about dread? Very much the same thing as we do about memorability. The thing to do with dread is to legitimate it, to get it on the table. A very, very good example of that in New Jersey a few summers back. Some of you may remember it. It was medical waste floating up on the shore. Okay. And the public looked at this, you know, syringes and whatnot floating up on the shore, and the public said, "Ugh, that's disgusting." The state DEP said, "It's not hazardous." And the public said, "That's disgusting." And the DEP said, "It's not hazardous." Now, what the DEP desperately needed to say is, "That's disgusting, but it's not hazardous." Okay. Now, in Rhode Island, they did that. The issue came to the Health Commission rather than the Health Department, rather than the Environmental Protection Department, and Denny Scott, the Commissioner of Health, got on television and he said something like this. He said, "The people of Rhode Island will not and should not tolerate medical waste floating up on our shore. It's true that the risk to human health is essentially zero. Nonetheless, it's disgusting. It's unacceptable. And the health department will do whatever it takes to put a stop to it." And you know what the public's response was? "Wait a minute. If it's not really a threat to health, how much are you going to spend?" And New Jersey would have killed for that response. Okay? And Rhode Island got it simply by legitimating the dread. By legitimating the dread, by taking the dread seriously, Rhode Island enabled the public to get past the dread. By ignoring it, New Jersey left the public stuck in it. Number 6 is the distinction between risks that are chronic and risks that are catastrophic. Okay, or as this is often thought of, risks that are diffuse in time and space versus risks that are concentrated in time and space. Okay. And I suspect most of you know what's coming here. All things being equal, and all things aren't always equal, but all things being equal, the public is much more concerned about catastrophe than it is about chronic risk. Okay. The same amount of mortality, okay, is going to generate a whole lot more outrage if it comes in great big clumps than if it comes one at a time spread out over space and time. Wonderful example of this is smoking. Smoking kills in the United States about 350,000 people a year. Okay. Imagine that they all had to die on November 13th in Chicago. Okay. On November 14th, we would outlaw smoking. We would not allow 350,000 people to die, even in Chicago, without immediately taking action. But that's not what happens, right? They die spread out over the year, spread out over the country in the privacy of their pain, and that's much more acceptable. Not just to other people, not just to peculiar citizens who don't have a technical education, but in fact to all of us. And let me try and prove that to you. Let's look at two scenarios. We'll make them power generation scenarios. In scenario one, it might be, say, solar power. And I'm making up these data. Let's say solar power kills 50 people a year. They die falling off their roof one at a time, spread out over the year, while installing or repairing their solar installation. Okay? And again, I'm making up the numbers. Okay. Meanwhile, the second power generation technology, might be some kind of power plant. Let's assume that it has one chance in 10 of wiping out a nearby community of 5,000 people sometime in the next decade. Okay, risk assessors, one chance in 10 over a 10-year period of killing 5,000 people. What's the expected annual mortality? 50. Same as solar power. Now, is there any doubt in anybody's mind that our society will accept a technology that kills 50 people a year spread out and would not for a moment allow the sword of Damocles to hang over a community of 5,000 with anything like one chance in 10 of wiping them out sometime in the next 10 years? Okay. That's not because we're stupid. It's not because we don't understand the numbers. It's not because we can't multiply, because we can't calculate. It's because we have and we share with you and with everyone else a value that tells us that catastrophe is more serious than chronic risk. The same number of deaths when they come all together disturb the universe more. Okay? And they disturb our psyches more. What does that mean? It means you have to take acute risk, you have to take worst-case scenarios much more seriously. The low-probability, high-magnitude risk deserves more attention than it gets given a quantitative calculation of expected annual mortality. It also means that more attention to reducing magnitude would be useful. That is, when the public looks at the high-magnitude, low-probability risk, it is looking mostly at the magnitude. It's looking at how many people might die. And reducing that number, addressing that number, taking that number seriously is terribly important. You can't say to people, it's true, we might end the universe, but it's highly unlikely.